America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Ed Huggins, is it Hudgens?
Hudgens, yeah.
Hudgens. Let me turn your mic up a little bit, Ed.
How you doing?
Great, great. Great to have you with us here. I am broadcasting today from the Conservative Political Action Committee or conference, CPAC.org. And boy, it's a zoo here, Ed.
Oh, yes, though.
Ed is the executive director of the Atlas Society, ObjectivistCenter.org. We have folks in the Ayn Rand Institute on regularly, so we talk about objectivism a lot, and I think we can have an interesting conversation here. Mm-hmm. First, I just want to set the stage for our listeners because we just opened the show. Ed and I are sitting in what is sort of a giant trade show area right across from us, Americans for Prosperity, the American Foreign Policy Council, Americans for Sovereignty, all this kind of stuff. Out in the hall, did you have to run the Mitt Romney gauntlet?
Yes.
Wasn't that incredible?
Yes.
There's all these, and you need to get right up on the mic there.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, there's like all these young scrubs, they kind of... With all the hits that Romney's getting right now for his grandfather being a polygamist or his great-grandfather being a polygamist and a Mormon, the kids out there all look like the Mormon missionaries. I mean, they're black suits, white shirt, black tie.
All that's missing is the pocket protector.
That's right, yeah. And they're all holding these Romney signs. And then there's this guy walking around in a
it's a flipper outfit.
Yeah, he looks like a dolphin.
And it's basically anti-Romney because Romney flip-flops.
Right.
Actually going from what I consider to be a sound set of policies, that is freedom across the board, to basically now he's suddenly seen the light and said, well, you know, maybe we should restrict freedom in some areas where the Republicans want us to restrict
Like abortion, for example.
Maybe stem cell research.
Yeah, the war on drugs and things. Yeah,
all that kind of stuff, yeah. Right. So suddenly he's had a conversion.
He's turned to the dark side of the force, as it were.
We would say, yes.
Yeah. So now, it's interesting. The Atlas Society, first of all, tell us about the Atlas Society.
Yeah, basically we're an organization. We've been around since 1990. David Kelly founded us. And actually, the reason is because we are objectivists. We believe that there's an objective reality. The human mind is able to understand that reality, that rational self-interest should be the moral goal of everybody's life and in laissez-faire capitalism.
Yeah.
But our organization in particular... believes in an open and tolerant approach to objectivism. Unfortunately, some other organizations, and you have some websites and blogs out there, are very intolerant. They treat it almost like a religion. And we say, no, I like Ayn Rand. The reason I call myself an objectivist is I think that she focuses on the important aspects of objective reality. But we believe in open questioning, open inquiry, whereas sadly in some of those circles they almost treat it like a cult.
I'm assuming was it in the 1950s Ayn Rand, when she was still alive, she had an organization, and Alan Greenspan actually went to her apartment in New York, and there was some sort of an initiation ritual that was associated with becoming part of her organization.
Is that the
Atlas Society?
No. That's something else. As far as I know, they never had anything like that. But the problem was that it did become, especially after her death, very very cultish. But I don't think that that's the essence of the philosophy. The essence of the philosophy is use your own mind. It's rational, responsible individualism. In fact, our publication is entitled "The New Individualist."
Right. And on the one hand, I salute that.
Yeah.
And on a lot of issues, I'm right there with you guys. Mm-hmm. And the area where we depart is the idea of the commons, the idea of the collective good, the idea of a social contract, And frankly, I've had that debate enough times with the folks from Ayn Rand that probably you and I don't need to have it again here. I'm curious about how the fact that objectivists favor the decriminalization of prostitution, favor the decriminalization of all drugs, all natural substances anyway, and positions that a lot of people at this conference would say are screaming liberal positions.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you also take what I would consider to be extremist conservative positions on a lot of issues, the doing away with government and not having social programs, essentially.
Well, we're for limited government.
Yeah, right. I'm just curious how are you being accepted here? What's the response?
It's very interesting because a Library of Congress survey, as you probably heard in the early 1990s, found that the second most influential book in America after the Bible was Atlas Shrugged.
Whoa.
Well,
Grover Norquist, I mean, a lot of conservatives these days are going around spouting you guys' rhetoric.
I can tell you lots of members of Congress I know personally who've spoken at our events who are not completely objectivist. I know some of them are Catholic and certainly were atheists, but who have read Ayn Rand and said, boy, did she ever get it right on this and that and the other, because she is a very powerful writer. Bob Barr, by the way, who is going to be speaking at this conference as well. It says Ayn Rand is one of the few people who understand the importance of privacy, and that's why one of the reasons he's opposing lots of aspects of the Patriot Act is based on Ayn Rand.
Yeah, and Bob Barr is, again, one of those kind of mixed bags, without getting into personal stuff.
Sure.
How do you deal with the argument? We're talking, by the way, with Ed Hudgens, who is the executive director of the Atlas Society. Objectivistcenter.org is the website. How do you deal with people who say, what about the social contract? What about the fact that we are in this all together? What about the fact that we are a nation of barn builders, not Davy Crockett's?
Right. I'll tell you, that's interesting, because we are not antisocial. And, in fact, here's my argument. In fact, I'm working on a book about this right now. I believe that everyone's goal should be to realize the best that they in life. It should be to do the things that they love. It's to whatever kind of creation.
Let me just stop, because you're predicating this.
Yes.
I mean, there's a predicate there, which is that everybody starts at the same place.
No.
And they don't. If you're born poor and black in New Orleans the day after the hurricane, it's a whole different thing than if you're born the son of Nelson Rockefeller.
I know. And by the way, I'm son of Italian immigrants, I've come from a working class background, and I had to scrub toilets and do all that kind of stuff to work my way up. And the nice thing about America is that you can do that.
Well, some of us can do that.
Well, the thing is, are you implying that there's some people who are simply in some way genetically incapable of doing these things?
I am saying right up front. First of all, yes, there are people among our society who are born mentally handicapped or physically handicapped.
By the way, I'm not talking about the very, very small number who might have Down syndrome or something like that. I'm talking about huge numbers of people. But here's the thing.
The point that I was making is that yes, I'm saying that people are born there are some people who are born with not just not having the bootstraps to pull themselves up by, but actively having the deck stacked against them. And there's the few that break through that.
But the thing is, it's not a few. Look, one of the things that I disagree with a lot of the folks at this conference on is immigration. And in fact, we have an issue of our magazine in which I wrote a major piece on it and basically said we should be proud of the fact that we are a country founded by immigrants. Now, but here's the thing.
So you think we should just open the borders?
I'll put it like this. I do believe in security, and I would basically have some kind of screening process. But I tell conservatives, don't get mad at people who are dirt poor in Mexico, who are watching their families starve and themselves starve. They don't know how to get through a Mexican and American bureaucracy, so they do the only moral thing. This is key. The only moral thing is to get up their butts and come to America and work.
The only moral thing for them to do is to get involved in Mexican politics and change that nation.
Well, I think that would be good, too. But the point
is...
if they come here, what happens is you dilute
the workforce. I mean, this is ultimately all about cheap labor for big corporations.
But the thing is, what it's about is this. It's about, I believe in the individual. And this, let me get to my point about your social question.
But you can't have an individual without society. An individual alone is going to die in the woods.
Let me tell you my vision of society, okay? Basically, everyone should do what they want, whether it's nurturing a child to maturity, a business to profitability, writing a song, a poem, or a business plan. And to the extent that we each do the things that we love, we will create a society in which we can be educated, entertained, enriched, enlightened, and inspired by our fellows.
We only have 30 seconds. Uh-huh. Can you name one society or country where your perspective has ever succeeded?
I believe to the essence of that society is in the United States of America, founded on the notion that we all have, as individuals, have the right to life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men.
That's the Declaration of Independence. In the Constitution, it talks about the common welfare.
What the culture of American society was, an individualist culture. And individualism doesn't mean that you don't work with others, cooperate with others, where it's in your rational self-interest. The thing is, you've got to do it based on mutual consent. And it's got to be a rational morality, not, by the way, a mystical one. And I think we probably agree on that point, too.
Interesting. Well, I look forward to speaking with you again in the future.
No problem.
Ed Hudgens, he's the executive director of the Atlas Society. Objectivistcenter.org is their website. Ed, good luck with some of the folks around this place.
Thanks.
Thanks for coming by. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. And
welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Here's how we're going to do the day. David has scheduled every other segment, which is every half hour. One of the conservative here. I'll give you the list for today, just to let you know what's going on. I'm broadcasting live from the Conservative Political Action Conference. I am the only liberal. They've got me. I've got empty spaces all around me on either side. Gordon Liddy's about five slots down. I don't think he wants to get close enough to me. And I'm also, I think, the only guy in this entire place. And there's like thousands of people. I mean, you can hear this. Let's see, which mic is it? Would it be? Let me turn it up here. You can hear what it's like. That's what's going on in the background. Right? It's just, I mean, there's thousands of people here. And I think I'm the only one here who's wearing jeans. Everybody, in fact, everybody I'm looking at right now is wearing black. I don't even see anybody wearing gray. It must be very fashionable to all's well, Carl. Thank you. It must be very fashionable to be wearing black and be conservative right now. So anyhow, that was Ed. At the bottom of this hour, Dr. Merrill Matthews, a resident scholar with the Institute for Policy Innovation, will be here. Grover Norquist may be here at the top of the next hour at 10 o'clock if he deigns to drop by. John Berthold of the National Taxpayers Union will be here at the bottom of the second hour, what would be 10:30 Pacific time, what would be 2:30 Eastern time, and then at 1:30 rather, excuse me, and then at 2 o'clock Eastern time, 11 o'clock Pacific time, Wendy Wright, the president of Concerned Women for America, will be here. And at 11:30, Flag Youngblood, Pacific Time, 2:30 Eastern Time, the senior programs and advancement officer at America's Young America's Foundation, YAF, which back when I was going door-to-door for Goldwater, YAF was Young Americans for Freedom. That'll be interesting to see what's going on. So we'll be debating with, talking with, trying to figure out what's going on inside the brains of some of these conservatives. And during the segments between those guests, I'll be taking your calls. So, for example, Tony in San Diego. Hey, Tony, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Love your show, and you're a courageous man for being there.
I've been warned, however. Dick Cheney's going to be speaking here this afternoon, and I've been warned that when he enters the room, you just kind of feel a dark rumble in your bones, and not to worry about that. That everybody kind of feels that. So,
well, I wanted to see if you could take the opportunity to ask some of those hawks there who call themselves conservatives what their plan is for Saudi Arabia and why they haven't taken any direct action against that country, even though that's where most of our terrorists have come from.
Yeah.
And I'll take my comments off the air. My cell phone is dying. Thanks for taking my call.
Okay. Sure. Thanks a lot, Tony. Great to hear from you. It's in fact, hang on just a second here. We're doing this show kind of on the fly and having to move some of the software around on my screen so I can even get to things. There we go. The whole Sunni Shia thing is something that I think most Americans are so confused about. And what's particularly confusing about it is our foreign policy. And it really deserves a minute or two of discussion. These two, the Sunni and Shia, you know, to make a lousy but probably useful parallel, is sort of like the Catholics and the Protestants. I mean, you know, they're both followers of Muhammad. One is following the lineage of Muhammad, the other the blood lineage, the other following the student lineage, as it were. And, you know, without getting into all the whole gory details, and each considers the other heretics, relatively speaking. The Sunnis are largely found in Saudi Arabia and all the Gulf states, Oman, Qatar, Jordan. The most of the Palestinians are Sunnis. There's a Sunni minority in Iraq, and then you've got the Taliban in Afghanistan was Sunni, and Osama bin Laden was Sunni, and Al Qaeda is Sunni. So that's all Sunnis. Those are all the Sunnis. The Shias are Iran is Shia. Now Iran, although Iran is hated by many of the other Arab states because the Iranians are not Arab. They consider themselves Persian. They consider themselves racially separate, and everybody in the region does. You know, it's like a different race, but they're also a different religion. They're also they're Shia, and Hezbollah, the organization that many would describe as a terrorist organization, that is really staked out in southern Lebanon, is a Shia organization. So now, and the majority of Iraq is Shia. So here now we have the situation where we're supporting the Shia in Iraq by supporting the Iraqi government, and you know, propping this up. And Maliki is a Shia, and yet at the same time, I believe, and yet at the same time, we're trying to stop the Shia from, you know, this Shia crescent, you know, from Syria to Iran into Lebanon, representing a threat to the region. And so we're like funding both sides. We find, you know, we're helping Saudi Arabia, and they're funding the Sunnis, and we just discovered 2-3 days ago that we're funding Sunni terror groups who are working against Hezbollah, including Al Qaeda, and at the same time we're funding the Shia through Iraq, and it's just an absolute mess. And if you can, you know, I don't think George Bush has any idea what he's into.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dr. Merrill Matthews, he's a resident scholar with the Institute for Policy Innovation, IPI.org, is here at the Conservative Political Action Conference. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Merrill's welcome. Welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
Glad to have you with us. You are represent yourself, I'm assuming it's accurate, as an expert on all things healthcare. Let's talk healthcare for a few minutes.
All right.
Why is the United States the only country out of 37 industrialized countries that considers health care to be a privilege rather than a right?
Because we do some things right every now and then.
Why would health care be a privilege rather than a right?
In fact, in statutory law, it actually is a right. Every hospital that takes Medicare and Medicaid patients, which is almost all hospitals, if you walk into the hospital, they have at least got to get you, they've got to provide you with the basic care. So you do have a statutory right.
But that's not a constitutional right.
It is not a constitutional right.
That only has to do with funding.
As a matter of fact, we don't have a constitutional right to food, housing, clothing, or anything else. And we've never added health care in that.
Well, the Constitution doesn't grant us rights. The Constitution limits the power of government.
That's right.
I mean, you know, the first three words of the Constitution, we the people, we're the holder of all the rights. But there is a long history maybe rights is the wrong word. There's a long history in the United States of our saying, okay, this is part of the commons that we collectively own. And that therefore, using the word right in a sloppy fashion, mm-hmm. therefore we say we have a right to it. People have a right to a public education. That's not in the Constitution either. And nor should it be, again.
And to answer your question, generally speaking, the public believes that people should be able to get the health care they need. The question is, how do you go about doing that? We have a whole system of public hospitals. We have Medicare. We have Medicaid. We have a patchwork system. It is not the best system. It's inefficient, and people fall through the cracks. But we do have a system to try to address the people who are low-income, uninsured, and those who need health care.
Right.
And the public generally supports that, and they would generally like to have everybody to have coverage.
But the system we have right now, if you look at Medicare, 3% of overhead.
I've actually done a whole study on this.
Sure.
When Medicare talks about the 2% administrative cost, that is simply what the government estimates is the cost to pay the claims. When you talk about the private sector being more expensive, that's because the private sector includes things like overhead, rent on the building, management, and so forth. Under Medicare,
$1.78 billion salary to Bill McGuire. The gold faucets in the bathrooms.
I understand, but understand, under Medicare, the head of the the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services,
right,
his salary is not included in the overhead. The building that houses all these CMS employees, they're not included in that.
Oh, because they're part of overall governmental expenses.
That's right. And right.
What do you calculate the actual overhead?
About 5.2% when you bring those in. Still less than the private sector.
I was going to say, let's assume that it's 5.2%.
Right.
Private sector, you're running anywhere from 20 to 30%.
Actually, the private sector, when you get to the large companies where you get the economies of scale, it runs about 8%, still more. But interestingly, what Medicare doesn't do in that is it doesn't go through and estimate. It doesn't try to manage claims. It doesn't look and say, has a doctor overbilled us?
Hang on just a second. You said the most efficient of the large private sector companies have 8%.
That's right.
So 8%. So 90. You're asserting that 92% or $92 out of 100 actually is used to deliver health care. If that's the case, how do these companies stay in business? Who would want to invest in a company that's not returning, that's not giving a return on their dividend, you know, that you can't get a decent dividend out of?
I'm not sure I understood that.
Okay. If you and I get together and we start a company and to make widgets, and we go out there in the world, we say, we got this company making widgets, and we want you to invest in it. People are going to say to us, okay, we'll invest with you because we expect you're going to make a profit and you're going to share some of that profit with us.
Right.
That's called a dividend.
Right.
And you know, typically companies are paying dividends 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, a good dividend, 10%. You know, ExxonMobil's paying real good dividends right now. So if you've got a company that's paying a 10% dividend to its shareholders, that's part of overhead. I mean, that's part of cost.
Absolutely.
So if a company is delivering health care at only 8%, and we know that the core cost is probably 5% because that's what Medicare does it at, how do they stay in business with only 3% overhead? It just doesn't sound possible.
That's the administrative cost. That's not the overhead. When you add that, profit and so forth, that bumps it up higher.
See, that's my point. That's why let's get rid of for-profit health care in the United States.
And why would you want to do that?
Because
that's
when I was growing up
out there.
Because when I was growing up in Michigan in the 50s and 60s, by law, the health insurance companies, Blue Cross Blue Shield, had to be not-for-profit.
Mm-hmm.
The hospitals had to be not-for-profit. I remember doctors making house calls. We had a system that worked.
But
now
You know,
first family's making a fortune.
You do know that a lot of the for-profit insurers and companies actually have premiums and so forth at about the same rate as the not-for-profit insurers.
Yeah.
The profit versus not-for-profit doesn't really make a sense. But remember,
the system is so badly broken.
You started this out talking about the other countries that have single-payer systems.
Sure.
Let's be clear. The other countries, they do spend less on health care. They also get less. There is rationing. There's waiting lines. They have universal
coverage. We have rationing and waiting lines here in the United States as well.
That's absolutely right.
And we have 43 million uninsured
people. About 46 or 47, actually.
Okay. All right.
You have them in both cases, but in the single-payer systems, you have waiting lines for just about everything.
Actually, you don't. I lived in Germany for a year, and I could pick up the phone, make an appointment with a doctor, and see him the next day. I thought I was having a heart problem one day. I called the hospital. I was there in 30 minutes. It was bang, just like that.
In most cases, the emergency systems work pretty well. Germany is one of the best of those systems out there. Switzerland is a very good system.
They're delivering health care at an average cost of about $3,500 per citizen. We're delivering health care at an average cost of what, around $7,000 per citizen?
Yes. And remember, what they do is they simply say from the government, from the top down, you can only spend this much on health care. You could say to your family, look, we've been spending $400 a month on food. We can't afford that. We're only going to spend $200 a month. You may still be able to feed yourself, but you're not going to get the same that you got for $400.
Oh, I agree with you on that. However, if everybody's a stakeholder in it,
right,
if 100% of the people are shareholders, and there's And they're making decisions like who they're going to vote for. They're elected representatives.
Yes.
And those representatives are responsible to them. Then I suspect, like with most of the other countries in the world, you're going to get a system that actually works fairly well.
It's an interesting point because most of the single-payer systems allow people to opt out of the system. For instance, there's an article in the Daily Mail in London here recently. They did a survey of physicians. Nearly a third of the physicians have private insurance and opt out of the national system. And another 10% said...
This is in the United Kingdom.
Yes, yeah. In England. Yeah. Another 10% said if they had a family member or they were sick, they would want private insurance as well.
Well, I would not ever put England's healthcare system forward as the model of what we should do.
Mm-hmm.
England has... probably one of the more dysfunctional of the national healthcare systems, and I would say frankly that goes back to Margaret Thatcher taking an axe to the thing because she thought that it should become like the American system. It should become privatized.
Well, she absolutely did, and they've been moving in that direction, and it doesn't.
And it's falling apart.
That they're trying to keep a real mix.
You got a Hurricane Katrina system down there. I mean, you know, it's like, let's break the government so we can say, hey, look at it's broken.
But which system would you put forward as model? Germany's better than most of them.
I'm all in favor of the German
model. Most of them look at Canada. Incidentally, Canada does what you were suggesting, which is you can't opt out of the system in Canada.
Right. Everybody's a shareholder.
Everybody
pays into it, by the way. It's a minimum. I think it's $40 a month.
That's absolutely right.
And if your income goes up, you pay a little bit more.
And if you read the Canadian papers or the New York Times, you will find the stories of the Canadians who come south of the border in order to get care that they can't get in Canada because of the waiting line.
Well, that's with cosmetic surgery. Surgery or hip replacement where they have to wait 6 months instead of a year.
Tom, I was actually on a bus about 3 or 4 years ago with Canadians coming south to Bangor, Maine, to the hospital in Bangor, Maine. One of the people on there, his cardiologist said, you need an echocardiogram, something here you'd get the next, you know, that day. He was in. That
if
was
you
in,
had insurance, or if you had the money,
they'll give it to you if you're at the public hospital.
No, they won't.
Yes, they
not
will.
An echocardiogram.
Oh, they absolutely will.
Oh, come on,
may not be able to get an organ transplant, but you can get an echocardiogram. But anyway, the point is, the guy had in May, the doctor had prescribed him an echocardiogram. His cardiologist, it was going to be November before he could do it. He was coming south to get an echocardiogram at Bangor, Maine. He couldn't get there.
And at the same time, I was probably about that same point in time. I was living in Montpelier, Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
Every Saturday, the bus would fill up with people to go to Canada to get pharmaceuticals.
Pharmaceuticals.
I mean, you know, it's like, and I, in the 10 years that I lived in Vermont, not once did I ever see anybody coming down from Canada looking for health care. But I know a lot of Americans who would have loved to have gone up there and been fully insured. But, you know, we're kind of, you know, batting the ball back and forth here. We're talking with Dr. Merrill Matthews. He's a resident scholar at the Institute for Policy Innovation. IPI.org is the website. We just have a minute left. What is your solution? I'll just let you have the final say here on this.
You have uninsurable people, and you have uninsured. The uninsured mostly are young, healthy people, and they tend to be lower income. So you want to provide some kind of tax credit to be able to help them be able to afford health insurance. The uninsurable, you've got 34 states that have high-risk pools that are state-created entities to accept people who are uninsured and uninsurable. Insurance doesn't work very well if you've already had a condition and you move into it. Just as it doesn't work very well if your house is burning down and you try to go and get homeless.
Well, to use that metaphor, I mean, if you get a tax credit, you get money once a year. I need the money right now. I can't wait until April 15th when I file for my tax credit.
The proposals for the tax credit are refundable. That is, if you're low income and you don't pay any taxes, you still get the money. And advanceable. You get it up front so that you can use that money towards buying
So if I'm low income and I need an echocardiogram, I go to the IRS and I say, I need my tax credit right now?
It would work like the earned income tax credit, where you would get a tax credit for insurance. You'd buy the insurance. You'd have to prove on your income tax that you have that coverage, and you'd have coverage then.
Interesting. Well, you know, the theater of ideas here. We'll see how it all plays out. Dr. Merrill Matthews, resident scholar with the Institute for Policy Innovation, IPI.org. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Thank you for being with us, Doctor.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. It's 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
Some stones, saw the skin and bones of a city without a soul. I went out walking an atomic sky, where the ground won't turn and the rain it burns like the tears when I said goodbye.
And welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you on Air America Radio. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Demo Chrysos is with us. He's the president of Rapid Response Media and has organized a campaign to directly lobby the President of the United States to issue a pardon to these two Border Patrol agents who got busted down in Texas, wasn't it, on the
right.
Texas border. And, Demo, you got to get right up on these mics.
Sure.
Because
okay.
They've got the... We're
gotcha.
Trying to keep yeah. down the ambient noise.
No problem.
First of all, you know, give us the setup.
Well, the setup was, as far as the case is concerned, these border agents are trying to apprehend a drug smuggler who brought 743 pounds of marijuana across the border, $1 million worth of marijuana. He gets spotted on the U.S. side of the border, bails on the drug, starts running. They tell him to stop. He doesn't stop. He turns, and apparently, according to the agents, he turned, and they thought they saw something shiny in his hand. They felt threatened, and they started firing weapons at him.
Right. One of them shot him in the butt.
One of them shot him in the butt.
Perforated his intestine or his kidney or urethra or something, and he ended up in the hospital.
Well, I don't know where he ended up. What he ended up doing is he ended up getting in some sort of vehicle on the Mexican side of the border and going disappearing.
Right.
So, and if you ask them, they weren't even sure they had actually shot him at that time.
Now, I've been through three rounds of thinking on this.
You know, a lot of people do.
When I first heard the original story, my take on it was, you know, these guys are getting screwed. Then I read the piece in the Wall Street Journal, which I'm sure you're familiar with, where I believe it was the Wall Street Journal, or there's the National Review. I'm pretty sure it was the Wall Street Journal, wasn't it? Where they came out and they said, you know, why is the right doing this? These guys discharged their weapons illegally. They tried to cover it up. There were other agents who actually turned them in.
Well, there's a lot of, you know, and since that story, a lot of things have sort of unfolded.
Right, and then this is the third thing now. Then
exactly.
then another guy comes out and says, well, you know, because the thing in the Wall Street Journal was like, these guys didn't feel threatened and they were just shooting at this guy.
Oh.
And then this third guy comes out and says, no, he had something in his hand. And now
it's
he's
in
saying,
the testimony. I mean, yeah. As soon as they released the testimony, you saw that in the testimony.
But a jury... You know, heard all the evidence
right.
and convicted these guys.
Okay.
And there are laws.
Okay. Well, let me answer that because I think I've got the explanation for that. It's very interesting the way the White House kind of talks about this. They say if people would listen to and look at what the jury saw. And what the jury saw, if you look at the testimony, was very, very controlled. Because every time the defense, every time these agents tried to challenge any kind of, you know, the integrity of this witness, this
right.
drug dealer, they were shut down. They were never
right.
allowed to do that. To the point where Johnny Sutton denied that there was ever a second load of drugs that were brought in while the guy was under immunity, and that has just unraveled as of yesterday.
So now we're in a flip four on this thing.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
Now, here's the larger picture. I hear, you know, Lou Dobbs has kind of made this his cause celeb, and a lot of folks who are opposed to illegal immigration in the United States broadly are adopting this as sort of an anthem, a marching thing. And frankly, I'm opposed to illegal immigration in the United States, although I think that we have an illegal employer problem, not an illegal immigrant problem. I think that if we started putting the employers in prison, people would stop coming across the border. And, you know, it's pretty simple stuff. But why put all this effort into these two guys? I mean, aren't there, particularly if it has to do with the immigration issue, aren't there bigger issues and aren't there other ways of getting it out?
Well, the way I looked at it, and, you know, I'm somebody who's been very supportive of the president, so this is where we break. I mean, I break with him on the...
You're a conservative Republican.
Conservative Republican. And so here's a situation where I literally self-finance these spots. It was sort of my Howard Beale, mad as hell,
yes.
I'm not going to take this anymore
yeah, and
moment.
Just for our listeners who haven't figured this out, maybe I didn't explain it in the beginning, Demo Chrysos is the president of Rapid Response Media, which is like an ad agency sort of...
It's a production company.
Production company.
Right.
And you have put this website up, pardontheagents.com, and you're running these ads in the Washington, D.C. market, where we're on the air, by the way. This program is on the air.
Okay.
And lobbying the president to pardon these guys.
Right. And let me clarify. What I did is I had the spot. So I was sort of all dressed up and no place to go. So I looked at grassfire.org, who had been running this petition drive and had already collected over a couple of 250,000 petitions to send to the president. I thought, well, let me partner with them. We'll put this, my spots on their site, and we'll promote this together. So
right.
this is a joint effort with Grassfire. I don't want to
right. So how do you feel about taking on the president? I mean, you know, here we are in this conservative political action conference.
I mean, well, you know, the way I look at it is like if the very first thing that the president does in 2007 to fix and secure our borders and fix the immigration problem is to use his silence to help send two Border Patrol agents to prison by not doing anything about it, while the drug smuggler has been given immunity and is now suing the government and taxpayers essentially for
sure.
$5 million,
well,
then something is really screwed up.
Respectfully, Demo Christos of PardonTheAgents.com, I'd say, you know, welcome to our hypocrite president. I'm sorry. I mean, you know, he lied us into a war in Iraq. He's given us nonsense on health care. The Scooter Libby's probably going to get a pardon. He's outed a CIA agent. I mean, he's wiretapping our phones illegally.
Is this
a wake up for you?
Well, no. The president clearly staked out his ground on the immigration issue. You know, and that's where I broke with him as far as it being a wake up.
So this is meta to that.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I think that what it is that I just got to a point where I saw what was happening to these guys, and I looked at that case, and every time you kind of peeled back another layer of the onion, the more it was...
It gets weirder, yeah.
It gets weirder.
Do you think that a lot of Republicans are starting to... Is this enough to make you walk away from George Bush?
Well, let's put it this way. I'm not exactly filling out the checks when I get the
RNC requests.
The RNC requests
yeah.
right now. And I think a lot of Republicans, and certainly, you know, people at the core, are wondering what is going on.
Yeah, interesting. Demo Christos.
Demo,
thank you. Demo Christos. He's the head of Rapid Response Media, their website, PardonTheAgents.com. Interesting conversation. Thanks for dropping by.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here broadcasting from CPAC.org, the Conservative Political Action Conference. We'll be right back.
Presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live. The only liberal in the entire Conservative Political Action Conference. Dan Gaynor is with me. Dan, you've been a regular on our program for, what, 2 years?
Probably about at least a year, sir.
Yeah. Yeah, for quite some time.
It's been a good run.
It has. Yeah, we've had a lot of good debates. Dan Gaynor is the director of the Business and Media Institute. And the website, which website?
Businessandmedia.org. It's businessandmedia.org.
Yeah, that's your favorite, because I've seen three websites here on your business card. And first time we've actually met in person.
Yeah, no, this is a nice thing. And you're not the only liberal. ACLU is here as well.
I think the ACLU is very conservative.
If you've spoken to the people of the ACLU booth, you would disagree.
Okay.
They were getting busted on by a fair number of conservatives right here.
Yeah. Now I'm curious. I am the only person here wearing jeans. I mean, it's like there's a uniform. Everybody here is wearing a black suit. Are you wearing a black suit? You are.
I'm wearing a gray, dark gray suit.
Okay.
Not a uniform.
Okay. You're not. Yeah. But and particularly.
Oh, come on. Look at the tie. Do I look like I'm following a uniform?
Actually, no. You're yeah. That's a pretty good tie. we should say it's a very unusual.
It's almost Middle Ages. It looks like it's illuminated writing.
Yeah, illuminated manuscript.
Yeah.
Beautiful, actually. The Romney guys out here. They it looks like Mormon missionaries. I mean, it's spooky. Have you run the gauntlet, or is it gone now?
I mean, every one of the political candidates here has a good number of supporters here wearing T-shirts, representing for them, trying to get people interested, get people motivated. That's bound to happen at any conservative event.
Just as it happened
at a liberal event, except they're wearing different shirts.
Sure, yeah, and a lot
maybe
more.
Maybe the Hillary pantsuit. You know,
yeah.
I don't know.
All right. Well, I'm just astounded at
we dress up.
I got this Sam Brownback literature this morning about how he's a Christian and all about that, and I thought that, you know, one of those values was poverty. You know, one of the Christian values is is not dressing up, is not, you know, ostentatious displays of wealth.
But dressing up is not necessarily it's a show of respect for an event. The vice president's supposed to be here at some point, you know, speaking. It's a show of respect for all the people. Most of us are here, I can say
well, that
for myself.
Sense. That makes sense.
You know, representing for organizations.
Sure.
And some people are here job hunting.
I'll give you that. As you sat down, you made a comment about the Oscars.
Oh, yes.
And you guys are still drinking this Kool-Aid that Al Gore's wrong about climate change.
What the Kool-Aid I'm drinking in this case is that Al Gore, well, I mean, he's certainly wrong. If you've seen his movie, even his own allies.
Not only did I see his movie, but I moderated one of his presentations, and I moderated a Q&A with him standing right next to me.
Okay, well, then the whole bit about 20-foot sea level rise, even the UN IPCC disagrees about that wildly. So, I mean, even on his side, he is out there.
There's a broad spectrum of possible scenarios that the IPCC is
talking about. He's picking hype. He's not picking.
I would suggest that what you guys are doing is you're picking pieces out of his movie. I mean, there's a big picture here, and the big picture is that if global climate change is real, then our children and grandchildren are going to live in a very different world, and one that may be very hostile, frankly, to human life.
Well, actually, there's several questions, so let's lay them out for people.
Sure.
First of all, is climate change happening? Secondly,
there's a consensus on that.
There are a lot of
even
people who
disagree.
And then the question is, if it is, what is the cause? Is mankind the cause? Is mankind part of the cause, etc.?
Right.
If beyond that, then what is it that we could do? And if beyond that, should we cost-benefit-wise? And then, I mean,
but here's my question, Dan. Dan Gaynor, businessandmedia.org. The conservative position, I would think, would be to say, let's do the cautious thing. Let's you know, if there's a possibility that this is going to destroy the lives of our children and our grandchildren, let's be cautious and invest in alternative sources of energy and cut back on the use of carbon and try to protect some of the forests of the world that are carbon sinks and things like that. It seems like that would be the conservative thing.
But the cautious thing that you talk about by every left-wing definition is somewhere in the range of at least 1% of GDP, which in the case of the United States is $120 billion a year. If you go back...
So that's, what, one-fifth the cost of the war in Iraq so far?
I was going to say, if you go
We're
back...
We're talking nothing.
It's not nothing.
According to Bush, it's nothing.
I never think $120 billion is nothing.
I mean, he's asking for another $100 billion for the war in Iraq.
If you go back then to the 1998-97 estimates made during the Clinton administration, so these are not Republican estimates, talking about the cost, just signing on for Kyoto would have been somewhere between $200 and $400 billion.
But we don't know that because if we had signed on...
millions of jobs.
No, you don't know that because if we had signed on with Kyoto, we might have developed... go back to Jimmy... We might have developed all kinds of new technologies that would be making all kinds of money. When Louise and I moved to Vermont 12 years ago, we've lived in Oregon for 2 years, but for 10 years we lived in Vermont. So 12 years ago we moved there from Georgia, from Atlanta. And we were looking for houses and, you know, traveling around the state looking for a place to live. And we kept finding these houses that were like passive solar. I mean, off the grid, totally passive solar. And they're just some really cool houses up there, you know, in the wood, in a place where there's not a lot of sun. I mean, very northern latitude. All of them were built in a 4-year period. All of them. None of them have been built since then because it was during the time when Jimmy Carter was offering tax breaks, tax incentives if you built houses this way. So if we had continued with that policy, if we had signed on for Kyoto, it's entirely possible that not only would we be saving a lot of energy right now, but all kinds of new technologies would have been developed, and we'd be in the middle of a whole brand new dot-com boom, only we'd be calling it the dot-sun boom.
Or it's possible that we might have just thrown a lot of money, good money after bad. It's easy to look back at history and say ifs and buts. I mean, that's, you know, we're talking about alternate history.
I'm talking
here,
about that, right now. Why don't we start doing this right now?
Because the conservative position would then be, let's say, I mean, what I would really like to see, there are scientists on both sides of this.
No, they're not.
There are.
There's not.
60 of them signed a letter to the Canadian Prime Minister not that long ago. 60.
60 climate scientists?
Climate scientists. Three of the state climatologists, three that I can name. You know,
yeah, like George, our state climatologist in Oregon, who's actually not even a climatologist.
Virginia.
He's a meteorologist,
Bill
and he doesn't actually work for the state.
Bill Gray, who is the most respected hurricane predictor in the country. He's supposed to be a brilliant guy when he's predicting hurricanes. Suddenly, when he talks about climate change, even though climate is hurricanes, suddenly then the left and the media treat him like he's an idiot. And that's ridiculous. What I would like to do, ideally, is get the scientists on both sides to at least agree on the facts of what has happened. They don't even agree on that. They don't even agree on the medieval warming period. They don't agree the hockey stick. Michael Mann won't release all the hockey stick, all the data that he used to come up with the hockey stick. I would at least let's agree on the past, then let's talk about the future, which is at best a prediction. Because
no, we're seeing change right now. You're seeing communities up in Alaska who are...
Climate has forever changed and will forever change.
We're seeing change right now that seems to be tracking back to what we are doing. I mean, you're looking at carbon dioxide levels now in the atmosphere that are approaching 500 parts per million. It was 300 parts per million when I was born, 300 and change.
Right. But 150
that's a huge
ago,
difference.
150 years ago, we were just coming out of the Little Ice Age. So, I mean, yes.
The Little Ice Age was a blip compared to what's going on.
550 years, not much of a blip. It was
In terms of variability, in terms of climate change, you've got communities in Alaska and northern Canada, Arctic communities, that have been there since humans first settled 20,000 years ago, maybe 30,000 years ago. There's a debate among archaeologists about that. But they've been there far more than 10 or 20,000 years, who are getting wiped out. You know, what was permafrost all that time is turning into mud.
Again, what I would like to do...
You've got glaciers vanishing. Mount Kilimanjaro.
Glaciers have vanished before. You look back to 1900. The media have warned us about this. Four different climate changes in the last 100 years. Pardon me if I'm a little skeptical when they're 0-3 for the first three, and now we're up to number four.
So we should do nothing.
I'm saying what I would like to do is to get scientists on both sides together, see if we can get everybody to agree on the past. Then we can talk about the future. Like I said, at best a prediction
from people
who can't even get the weather right tomorrow.
You know, I think this is a corporatist point of view that's like, you know, sucking up to the oil industry, not a conservative point of view. I want to call you out on that.
I will guarantee you, because I'm speaking on a panel tomorrow on this, I will guarantee you the vast majority of Republicans and conservatives, conservative Democrats, this is their position because they don't want to make a radical change that essentially ruins the U.S. economy for benefiting the world. China's not signed on to Kyoto. A lot of the big polluters in the third world aren't going to agree to anything.
Oh, yeah, we've got some huge problems.
Al Gore says
so
it's
we could
okay
set a good
build,
example.
Al Gore thinks it's okay to build coal plants in China, but he doesn't want to build in the United States. That's hypocrisy.
Well, I don't know. I've not heard Al Gore saying that it's okay to build coal plants in China. Maybe he did. I don't know. There's one I don't know. Dan Gaynor, anyhow, he's the director of the Business and Media Institute, businessandmedia.org. Dan, nice to meet you.
Always a pleasure to meet you in person.
Okay, good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll take your calls right after this.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The pill that will help you escape the matrix. It's Air America Radio. Here I am, the lone conservative in the lone liberal in the conservative world at the Conservative Political Action Conference Radio Row. Someone had to do it, right? Somebody has to plant a flag here. Oh, my. I'm looking at a life-size picture of Ann Coulter right now. I'm not sure I want to do that very much longer. 1-866-303-2270 is our telephone number. Scott in San Diego. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, Tom, or good afternoon. I'm listening to you today. You're broadcasting live here in San Diego. It's very exciting. I'm happy to have that happen.
Thank you. Me too. We're very pleased to be on KLSD.
I am quite happy to hear you live. No more worrying about the stream. It is so exciting, something I was hoping for a long time. You know, I want to call you Jonah. You're broadcasting.
Why is that? You think I'm about to be eaten by a whale?
No, you're broadcasting from the belly of the beast.
Oh, yes, it's true. It's true. Yeah, so, but that's not what you called about.
Well, no, but it did trigger the call. The conservatives always come back on global warming as if it's just warming, and we've had warming before, when, to me, it's more about an overall ecological collapse. It's about everything kind of falling apart. It's like
We're looking at 50% of all the species on Earth vanishing within the next 30 years. Stuart Pym is one of the most articulate spokesmen on this, and we had him on the program about four or five weeks ago. He and I were part of a think tank, a private group that met down in San Francisco on this topic, and it's absolutely horrifying. I mean, and when you think that all the various species of life on Earth are like the various organs of our body, and you know, you can your body will continue to work if you only have one eye or one kidney or one ear or one leg.
I have actually one diaphragm, and my one lung doesn't work really well because that one diaphragm that doesn't work well doesn't drive the lung anymore, so it doesn't breathe, and I've only got one arm that works, so my other arm doesn't work really well. And what that means is, overall, a physical or occupational therapist told me this, I've lost over 25% of my total metabolism, which means I don't recover as you would.
Yeah, and this is what's happening with the loss of species.
Exactly, with the entire world. And so what happens out of that is toxins build up in my body rapidly where you naturally get rid of them as your body works. So as the earth starts to collapse, the bacteria and viruses, the molds and spores and fungi are going to grow dramatically because there's nothing to take those things away anymore.
Yeah.
We're creating an environment where they're going to grow rapidly.
Yeah, and they already are. I mean, we're seeing this. We're seeing the emergence
of ecological collapse, not just global warming.
Yeah, I well said, Scott. Thank you very much.
You're
welcome. I agree. James in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, James.
Hey, Tom. Are you sure you're not at a convention of a sociopath?
The conclusion that I'm coming to from the folks that I've been talking to is that, you know, I think that there's a small number of sociopaths who are actually driving much of the agenda, but they're not the people who are here. They're the people who are, you know, in the back rooms and funneling the millions of dollars to the political action committees. Then there's a bunch of people who are just doing something because it's, you know, they're not really politically sophisticated and they're paid for it. And then there are some true believers. There are some people who actually think that there's, you know, their worldview is right.
It's really frightening, though. You know, after seeing what we've seen for this last 4 or 5 years, and as you said, the Kool-Aid that's still being imbibed, you know, regarding global warming to health care. You know, I had a conversation with a friend of mine the other day, and he's a conservative, and I'm liberal, and he asked me, why are you liberal? And I go, I guess it's because I realize I live in the real world. If I lived in a perfect world, maybe I would be conservative. But when you live in a real world, you have to deal with real world situations. You have to think on the fly. You have to adapt.
Yeah.
And I think that's the willingness of liberals.
And we also live in a community of people. You know, we're all in this together, and that's the core liberal value, frankly, going all the way back to the founding of this country, going all the way back to the Enlightenment. Absolutely well said, James. Thank you very much for the call. Fred in Detroit. Hey, Fred, what's on your mind today? Thanks for listening on WDTW, by the way.
How you doing?
Great. I'm great, but I'll get better.
Yeah. Well, things look like they're getting better. And I was just kind of wondering, you know, the way things are going, people really need to look at the way things are going and...
Look at the what? I'm sorry?
The way things are going.
Yeah. Yeah.
Our leader in the White House doesn't really have our best interests in mind.
Well, I don't think he ever did. I mean, Bush has always been pretty upfront about the fact that, I mean, obviously not in his campaign commercials, but you look at his history, you look at his life, you know, that he's of, by, and for the very wealthy, you know, the uber wealth.
Well, this is true, and
some people call you the elite, I call you my base. Remember that joke? I'm sorry, I interrupted you there, Fred. Go ahead.
No, right. His bunch, they make over $100 million a year, and I'm sorry to say that I make a lot less.
Yeah, yeah. And welcome to the club. And
the thing that I was calling about was The people really need to understand that these boys, they're pulling a flim-flam on this country.
Oh, yeah, and in so many different ways. I'm sorry, we've got to take a break here at the bottom of the hour, but yeah. Yeah. And we're going to hear more of it. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here broadcasting from the belly of the beast in Washington, D.C. Talk radio for the rest of us. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio, 34 minutes past the hour, broadcasting live from the belly of the beast here in Washington, D.C. at the Conservative Political Action Conference. CPAC.org is their website if you want to read all about it. John Bertu is with us, sitting right here across from me. He is the president of the National Taxpayers Union, NTU.org, the Big Cheese.
Big Cheese. Tom, great to be with you.
Glad to have you here with us, John. You guys, this is your mantra, and this makes me crazy, and I'm so looking forward to talking to you about
sure.
this. It's your money; you should be able to keep it, right? In fact, you say our guiding principle since we first started in business back in 1969 has been: this is your money, and the government should return it to you.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to walk into a 7-Eleven and pick up a Snickers bar.
Mm-hmm.
And take a bite out of it. But your money's still in your pocket. That dollar that Snickers bar, I don't have any idea what they cost these days, but let's say it's a buck. That dollar that Snickers bar costs, is that your money or is that 7-Eleven's money?
Well, now it's 7-Eleven. I mean, it should be 7-Eleven's money.
As soon as you've used it.
Yeah.
So you are using public streets.
Mm-hmm.
You've used public education.
Mm-hmm.
You're eating food that you know is safe. We're citizens here in this country. We're using the services. It's not our money.
Right.
We have engaged in a social contract by virtue of staying in this country as citizens of this country. And part of that social contract is that we're going to make a commitment in advance that
mm-hmm.
we're going to pay for it. So it's not our money.
Oh, absolutely. Look, I'm not going to agree with that. I mean, we're not anarchists.
You mean you're not going to disagree with it?
Not disagree.
Then why use a slogan like this?
The slogan is because, you know, government is in so many ways, in ways probably you and me and some of your listeners would agree with, government is not doing the core missions it should be doing, or it's spending money in ways that it shouldn't be spending. You know, do we need roads? Absolutely. Do we need education? Absolutely. But, you know, we have, and it goes down the list, critiques of how government is doing so many of these programs. We need the core business of government to get done, but we don't need it at a Cadillac crisis. We don't need it with subsidies being handed out to everybody on K Street, and so let's return the dollars and have, we're not saying taxation at no level, but taxation at a reasonable level.
But Here's my problem with this. And by the way, is the gain in your headphones okay?
Yeah, perfect.
Everything's
thank
fine.
You.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Here's my problem with this. I hear this mantra, and I hear it from a lot of right-wing talk show hosts mm-hmm. in particular, it's your money. And what it does in my mind is it destroys, particularly in the mind of young people who perhaps have not been in this country, haven't been alive long enough to see the shared sacrifice that we're all part of, or the shared responsibility that we all have, the fact that we're community, the interrelatedness of us all. It in my mind, what it does is it destroys that sense of community that is one of the things that makes this country so great. It's an elevation of selfishness.
See, I would turn that around, and when I see education policy that in many ways is driven by the interests of labor unions and not...
How can education policy be driven in the interest of a labor union other than the teachers get paid? Are you saying that the curriculum is...
Look, starting with the creation of the Department of Education... everything from not allowing school choice and competition. I mean, what's so wrong about having some competition? Of course, the labor union
every,
like that.
Well, every, actually, there is competition right now. There's plenty of private schools out there.
Right, but if you're
and
rich.
There are people
rich,
who are homeschooling.
If you're rich.
Yeah, exactly. And, so, and all of the proposals that I've seen for so-called school choice have been right. vouchers for $2,000 and $3,000 and $4,000. And we all know that the core cost, the national average, is around $5,600, right. which means that these are just subsidies for rich people.
Right.
Well, I mean, you know, and they're ways of creating dumping grounds out of the public schools. I mean, these are not attempts to fix public education, this whole school choice thing. These are attempts to destroy it. This is the same thing that Bush did with Katrina. You know, you break the system and then you say, hey, look, it's broken. It must be government.
See, I'm going to disagree with that. And then on the Katrina, you know, sure, there's all kinds of fault with the response of the federal government to Katrina.
Well, even before the response, Bush knew this thing was coming and he went golfing.
Well, first of all, you know, building levees and those kind of things, that's always in our country been traditionally a local response. And, you know, there was a study done, and everyone likes to make jokes about, oh, you know, the good old boys, and we all smile and talk about, you know, the backstop in politics in Louisiana. Louisiana, by and this is not some right-wing or left-wing, some group looked at public service provision in Louisiana and rated them about the worst in the country in terms of delivering dollars to infrastructure.
Yeah, but it wasn't Louisiana that built the dikes. That was the Army Corps of Engineers.
Well,
I mean, these were federal projects.
Sure, but you know,
and it was a federal response. I mean, that storm overwhelmed that state.
Well,
we're off course here, I'm concerned that we're talking with John Bertu, the president of the National Taxpayers Union, and ntu.org is your website.
Yep.
And we should really try to keep the conversation, I think, probably to the issues that are closest to your heart and you know what you're about. You're going to be talking here 2:15 this afternoon mm-hmm. here at the CPAC conference. And what is the call for action? I mean, as I said, you've got this slogan of it's your money. Is it about... I mean, already we're $9 trillion in debt, or pushing that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not our money. I mean, it's, you know, Bush came along and he said with $550 billion in tax cuts, we're going to create 1 million new jobs. That's $550,000 per job. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. Why are you guys not advocating for a balanced budget?
We are. Look,
you are.
We're advocating for a balanced budget. And
for fiscal sanity. But you realize a balanced budget is going to require massively raising taxes.
Well, I don't think it will, but we can talk about that. But, you know, to me, you know, when I look at the national debt, and I think you're talking about the gross debt, the net debt is a more meaningful number, whichever it is.
Wait a minute. What's the difference between a net debt and a gross debt?
Well, the gross debt is all debt. That's been issued by the government. The net debt is just that is which is publicly held. The gross is there's a lot of intergovernment transfers.
Oh well, the
Social Security Administration.
The gross debt is a whole lot larger than $9 trillion.
Well,
that $9 trillion debt doesn't include the Social Security Trust Fund that's been borrowed from.
Well, it does.
Oh, but, it does.
Yeah, it does. But big number and the big enchilada is the unfunded liabilities in Social Security and Medicare.
You know, you guys talk about that, but you don't talk also about the unfunded payments. I mean, you know, if you say, well, we'll look out 30 years and it's going to be $50 trillion, right? Something like that.
$39 trillion,
yeah. And, well, you look out 50 years, you're going to have a lot of income, too. And if we just took the cap off...
No.
I mean, why should I pay income tax or pay Social Security tax on 100% of my income?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you pay up to $94,000 a year, 100% of your income.
Yep.
And Bill Gates pays it on 5% of his income or 1% of his income. What's fair about that?
The reason that's been done historically, and that was something established by the Democratic Party, not the Republican Party.
And the reason
it was established is because there's supposed to be a connection between what you put into the system and what you get out. The reason Ted Kennedy and a lot of folks hate means testing, i.e. cutting benefits to upper-income people, which we've been strong supporters of for a long time. You know, Medicare Part B, you and I and all your listeners, right now, a lot of rich people in Florida, we're picking up 75% of their Part B Medicare
costs. Right, and the reason why Kennedy opposes means testing things like Medicare and Social Security is because as soon as you means test those programs, as soon as you say, okay, rich people are not eligible for Social Security, then you have transformed them from entitlement programs into welfare programs. And welfare programs are really easy to destroy.
Yeah, but all, I mean, for example, in Bush's budget, he's not talking about cutting off by any means. He's talking about, like, nudging.
No, but this is the camel's nose under the door.
It's the same thing on the tax side. The reason on the tax side is that we have the tax cap is because to keep that connection. And I find it interesting on the liberal side of the equation opposing means testing for the reasons you argue, but I'll ask you a question. Don't you think that you lift that cap, or is there concern that you're going to have the same thing that people who make more than $100,000 a year are going to say, you know, for as bad a return as Social Security already is slated to be, it's going to be much worse a return. And, you know, for the same reasons that Ted Kennedy opposes mean testing.
No, because your fundamental premise, which is that Social Security is somehow some kind of an investment program, is wrong. The original Social Security program was set up as the widows and orphans survivor benefit and Social Security program. A third of the people who are getting Social Security payments are not retired persons. They're disabled persons. Social Security is a social safety net. It's not an investment program. And so... if Bill Gates is paying 7% of his income, whether his income is $94,000 or whether his income is a $1 billion a year, that's the percentage of the commons that he is participating in. That's the part. That's the percentage of society that he's participating in. And I think that when we start trying to, when particularly conservatives start trying to talk about Social Security as an investment program, that's the beginning of the process of trying to destroy it so that it can be replaced by these private retirement programs.
Right. Well,
you're upfront about that, aren't you?
What we're upfront about is the fact that, you know, if you just say, I'm not sure the argument I hear from you. On the one hand, you say that it shouldn't be a welfare program, but on the other hand, you're saying people shouldn't look at it as a retirement, you know, part of their retirement plan.
Right. I'm saying it's part of the social safety net. Yeah. Well, interesting conversation, and people can read more about your perspective on NTU.org, the National Taxpayers Union. John Bairtou, thanks for being with us.
Hey,
John.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back. Truth and Common Sense on the radio for a change in America. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the belly of the beast here, the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington, D.C. Len in New York City, listening on WWRL. Hey, Len, welcome to the program.
Hey, I just spoke with you the other day, but there's one thing, while you're talking to all these conservatives, they love to invoke John Kennedy, who cut taxes, as evidence about how great it is to cut taxes, and even he understood it. But the thing to point out to them is that when he cut taxes, tax rates were something in the neighborhood of 80-90%.
90% was the top marginal tax rate. He took it down to 70. I actually have a clip that about every 6 months I play on this program, and I can't do it right now because my computer's not hooked up to a mixer where I can do that. But I have it on the computer of Jack Kennedy in the debate with Nixon in one of those three debates where he says that he said, I know, my family, you know, has a lot of money. He says, nobody's paying that 90% tax rate. There's a million loopholes. And so what he wanted to do was close the loopholes and drop the top rate from 90 down to 70%. And he said doing so would be a tax increase. He said it would generate additional government revenue. It was not the Lafler curve Kool-Aid that these cons are drinking. It was just very straightforward policy. And then he says, and we'll use that additional money to improve education, to improve social services. He had a laundry list of things he was going to use the extra money for. He was right up front about the fact. that it was a tax increase.
The thing to turn around and point out to them is just like when you have somewhat fat, when you are somewhat fat and you cut your caloric intake, you actually create a healthier body. But at some point, if you continue to cut your caloric intake, you actually do harm to yourself since you don't have the energy to take
It's called
care
starvation.
Of the
meat. It's called starvation. And that's and it's a good point, Len, and that's what these guys are about. You know, Grover Norquist with his, well, let's just drown it in the bathtub. I mean, they are about starving what they call the beast, which I call, you know, American democracy. Justin, thanks for the call, Len. Justin in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Justin.
Pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for fighting the good fight there.
I'm doing my best. I'm getting some strange looks.
Well, I just want to say how much I appreciate your show. It's just great listening to you, and I'm pleasure to talk to you. Yesterday, I listened to Ben Bernanke's testimony in front of the House, and some questions on Social Security came up that I thought you might be able to clear up for me.
Sure.
I'll ask three very quick questions. My main one is the first question, which is, if I understood correctly, the surplus that we have been running and continue to run in the Social Security is being invested in non-interest-bearing IOUs from the U.S. government.
Right. It's a unique form of treasury that was created. The expert on this is Ravi Batra. Ravi Batra wrote a book called Greenspan's Fraud, which I highly recommend, and it lays all this out. And I've had Ravi on the program a couple times, and I've read his book. In fact, it was one of my BuzzFlash books of the month maybe 2 years ago when it came out. And my recollection, so I may be wrong in some of the small details here, but basically my recollection is that when in 82 or 83, whatever the year was, when the commission, you know, the Greenspan and Moynihan Commission said, let's have one generation tax, pay not only for their parents' retirement, like the previous generations had prior to 1982, but also pay for their own retirement. And because the baby boom is going to be this rabbit going through the python. So we're going to set this money aside and put it into this trust fund. And ideally, I think at the time, there was even the plan that it would be invested in a way that would make money. Perhaps there was some debate about that. But then when Reagan started borrowing that money because he was doing his Lafler curve tax cuts and it didn't work, it didn't increase tax revenues. What it did, I mean, tax revenues went up over time because the economy grew, but not because of Reagan's tax cuts. I mean, he threw this country into a huge deficit. And the result, anyhow, you asked me what time it is. I'm telling you how to build a clock here, Justin. Your next question.
Well, you are touching on, I will read the book, Greenspan's Fraud, because I'm looking at why can't we be investing that money in treasury bonds, and wouldn't that help alleviate the future deficits that we're looking forward? And is anybody proposing that, looking at that?
Well, my understanding is that it is invested in treasuries. When Bush,
they were non-interest bearing.
That's right. Well, either non or very, very low. They're a non-standard form of treasury, and I don't know the details on that, frankly.
Okay.
When Bush went to, during the election before the election, when he was running around campaigning for privatization of Social Security, he went to Virginia and he opened the drawer and he pulled out the piece of paper and he said, "This is the Social Security, it's just paper."
That was silly.
I mean, well, it was tragic because, you know, number one, they are treasuries, and that's, you know, saying to the rest of the world, gee, the government might default on its treasuries. But it also highlights the fact that there is this massive amount of money, these trillions of dollars that have been borrowed by Reagan and Bush and Clinton and Bush. And the only guy to have honestly talked about this, frankly, was Al Gore during the election when he was talking about building a lockbox.
It's hiding the current deficit. I mean, we're running $400 billion deficits, and they're claiming they're only going to be $200 billion because spending the surplus. But if they had to actually borrow the money from the government and pay interest to those of us who have paid into that fund, it seems that would help protect the Social Security into the future.
Yes, also, and the problem is with that, though, is that how is the government then going to pay itself back? they're going to have to raise income taxes or raise some other kind of tax in order to get enough money to pay back the trillions that have been borrowed from the Social Security Trust Fund. And that's the thing that nobody wants to talk about.
Numbers. I wouldn't mind looking at some numbers at that, to be honest. Because this is our money we've invested, and rather than looking at privatizing accounts and letting me invest the money, why not just invest the money that we've already put in there and have it give us a return, and so that we're using honest.
Spot on, Justin. Spot on. And the problem, and nobody wants to talk about this in government, particularly the Republicans, because they don't want A, Greenspan's fraud to be exposed, and B, they don't want to talk about what are they going to do about taxes. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Conservative Action, the CPAC. What is it, Wendy?
Conference.
Yeah, Conservative Political Action Conference. There you go. There we go. Conservative Political Action Conference. It's been a long day. I got in at 1 o'clock, 1:30 this morning, and anyhow, Wendy Wright is with me. She's the president of Concerned Women of America. CFWA.org is the website. And Wendy, I want to say I spot on agree with you on your diagnosis of one of our major social ills. I disagree with you on the solution, but and we can talk about both if that's all right.
Sure.
And that's you talk about the sexualization of girls in our media.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, there was this media feeding frenzy around Anna Nicole Smith and Britney Spears in the last couple of weeks. And the story in my mind was not, you know, what's going on with these crazy women, in quotes. I don't mean, you know, to put them down. I mean, that's how they were being portrayed in the media. That wasn't the question in my mind. The question in my mind is, how have we no man would be out there doing that. I mean, you just don't find men who are using their sexuality, or very rarely do you. I suppose you could argue that Arnold Schwarzenegger, when he was a bodybuilder, was kind of into that. But by and large, the sexualization of men is not something that happens in our society. You could argue that teaching violence to them is something that happens. That's a whole other topic. But with girls and women, it's frankly, I think that's the story behind the story here.
I agree with you. And you know, as a woman, what I find is that we're just pushed from our culture that your value as a woman is if you are attractive. If you are sexually attractive, not just attractive as in pretty, but you have to be sexually attractive as well. And I think, sadly, with these women, their whole sense of worth was wrapped up in that,
right?
If they are sexually attractive to others.
Right. And that's really not enough. I mean, you just can't live your life on that. I mean, it's not even a fraction of enough.
Yeah.
And to have your identity be tied up in that, and yet that's the message that our culture is sending, particularly our children. I mean, I'm the father of two daughters. I have three kids. Two of them are girls. And that's the message. In fact, we didn't have a television in our house
for
18 years.
Wow.
We raised our kids without television.
Wow.
And in part, you know, not specifically about, you know, sexualization of kids, but we just thought that, there was a fairly toxic message out there.
Mm.
And here I am, a liberal. I mean, this is not a conservative or liberal thing. I think that there's a pretty broad consensus. Where I think we split is your call for heavy federal prosecution and the use of laws. And certainly child porn and things like that, I'm with you on. But the John Ashcroft covering up the breast of Lady Liberty. I mean, haven't we gone too far in the way of saying let's deal with this as a criminal issue when we're completely ignoring the elephant in the room, which is this multi-billion-dollar industry that is feeding, frankly, the conservative machine that you're a part of.
Well, actually, I would it's certainly not feeding my organization. In fact, just the opposite. They wouldn't want to feed us because we address both cultural and political or legal issues. For example, our ladies in Missouri were very offended by these massive posters being shown in Abercrombie & Fitch stores. You may be aware of their catalogs, very racy catalogs.
Are these lingerie posters or something?
Well, let's say here's a store that's selling clothes, but there are pictures in their catalogs of people not wearing any clothes.
I see.
And so normally what would happen is they put these wall-size posters in the back of the store, and then their argument is, well, if you're offended by it, don't go into the store. But in this store in Missouri, they were putting it in the windows facing into the mall. So if you were just walking down the aisleway of the mall, you were bombarded with these images. So our ladies went to the manager of the Abercrombie & Fitch store and said, I don't want my children seeing this. And the manager simply didn't care. So they did something I thought was quite smart. This was probably a month or two before Christmas, the biggest shopping time of the year. And they went to the managers of the department stores in the mall. Now, the department stores are the anchor stores. They're the ones that generally draw in customers, and then the customers walk around the mall and go to the smaller stores.
Right.
They said to them, we don't feel safe bringing our children into this mall. We don't feel that we can shop. Exactly.
Yeah.
Because
and it worked?
It worked. The department store managers put pressure on the mall management. The mall management told the store they had to take it down.
Interesting.
So I think we need to work both the cultural and legal aspects.
Right. Now also there's a distinction that I think needs to be drawn between using commercial messages that sexualize our children or promote the Britney Spears complex, for lack of a better phrase. I just want to be a dirty girl kind of thing, that we see 10-year-olds, trying to emulate now, on the one hand, and what I would call recreational pornography on the other hand. The adults looking at pornography in the privacy of their own homes. And I'm curious if you differentiate those two or if you are, as an organization, opposed to any portrayal of nudity or sexual activity or anything.
Well, there's the nudity that's considered artistic. But there is a serious problem. When we track back with children who have been molested, in nearly every case, what happens is the molester uses pictures of adult pornography, not children being used sexually in these pictures, but adults. Show those pictures to the children, and then by do that break down their sense of modesty. Say, wouldn't you want to do this? Right.
There were child molesters, long ago. I mean, Lot had sex with his two daughters.
They were adults, but
I don't know. I mean,
they were pregnant,
they might have been teenagers. I mean, they were.
but going back to the issue of pornography and adult pornography, the idea that it's kind of a victimless recreational endeavor. There have been now enough testimonies of women who were used in pornography, whether the pictures taken of them or they worked in strip joints or the rest. Many of them have come out and consider themselves victims of pornography. In fact, they have there's a website called Victims of Pornography in which they tell their stories of how harmful it was to them.
Are you conflating these, or are you just saying that these are two separate issues that you're both opposed to? Pornography and the use of sexual images in commerce, let's say.
Well, I think you can't really separate because one is used for the other. Now, what I think many people seem to either not know or forget, that there are laws that have been upheld by the courts on obscenity.
Right.
So not all pornography or obscenity is legal. And so there's the problem we've had is a lack of enforcement. These laws are on the books. The courts have said that they're fine, they're constitutional, but there's been a lack of will on the part of some law enforcement to crack down. And I think because of that, that's one reason we've seen such a proliferation of pornography and obscenity, getting worse and worse.
Do you think that's because most of law enforcement is male-based and they think, hey, this ain't so bad?
I think that is an issue.
Or do you think that it's that they're saying, there's people out there killing people? you know, we've got more serious things to worry about.
Well, there's some of that because there's a U.S. attorney in Miami who, following the lead of the Attorney General, Al Gonzalez, said that obscenity is a priority, and he got pushback from the attorneys in his office who are saying things like that. Oh, we have more serious things to deal with. But as Al Gonzalez has said, look, we've got plenty of people in the FBI. We can do more than one thing. We can fight terrorism and uphold all the other laws.
So Alberto Gonzalez is making a renewed effort to support your...
He has spoken out on this and said that it's a priority.
Yeah, as did his predecessor, apparently.
I'm not sure if Ashcroft said that. I would hope so.
He just covered up Lady Liberty.
Well, we need to recognize the photographers were actually doing contortions on the floor just so they could get that in the shot.
Yeah. But
kind of goes back to the media.
But it's a statue. But I guess it was really Ed Meese was the last Attorney General to really go ballistic on.
Well, you may recall what happened was when he had the Commission on Pornography, and as he was releasing the reports of the harms of pornography in our society, that's when the photographers literally did contortions on the floor in order to, in their pictures that they would run with that story, have the statue's breast right behind his head.
Right. Oh, interesting. Well, interesting conversation. Wendy Wright, she's the president of Concerned Women for America, CFWA.org is the website. She's here at the Conservative Political Action Conference. And are you speaking?
I spoke this morning.
Oh, good on you. Well, thank you for coming by on the
Thank you.
Up on our program. Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I'm at the live at the Conservative Political Action Conference. CPAC.org is their website in Washington, D.C. The only liberal in amongst... Craig, how many people do you think are here?
Millions.
Millions.
Millions of men. Come on down. The show is great.
Craig Bannister just dropped by. He's the director of communications for CNSNews.com, the Cybercast News Service. And for those of you who are longtime listeners to this program, several of your folks, Craig, particularly David Tebow, have been regular guests on our program.
Right.
And you're the guy behind the scenes. You're the guy who kind of makes it happen. You're the guy who sends out the emails and things like that. And I thought it would be interesting to our listeners for us to have just a brief conversation about how conservatives market conservatism and how you're marketing all this stuff and why, for that matter.
But
first I want to ask you about David.
Yeah.
David was a regular on our program. He and I could never find anything that we agreed on and had a lot of great disagreements.
That's what makes such great radio.
I think it made great radio, and frankly, I've never met David, but I've been debating him on the air for, what, 2 years, 3 years, something like that?
Yeah.
And it's been a long time. And David he had cancer some time ago.
Leukemia.
Right. And that. Well, he originally had testicular cancer. And then
5 years ago.
Right. And then the radiation treatment from that caused him to get leukemia now.
Exactly.
Recently. And he's been quite sick. And a lot of our listeners have sent notes to him and you know, get well notes and things. And
absolutely.
How's he doing? I know you were getting a bone marrow transplant.
He did. He was very, very fortunate. They found a 10-point match for him in Germany.
10 out of 10?
I believe so, and they overnighted the bone marrow, and he had the transplant at 2 a.m. in the morning, about 3 weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
Right now, immediately afterwards, they gave him another round of chemo to obliterate all his remaining blood cells.
Right. Yeah, I know. He was quite sick.
So it almost kills you,
yes.
The treatment. And now they're waiting for the counts, his blood counts, to start rising again, which they're doing.
Right, good.
They're all in good.
I look forward to him coming back in the program and telling me once more why he's against public, you know, national health care system.
Exactly.
We should.
And I'm sure he'll have strong views about that
after this. Actually.
He'll probably tell you, you know, he appreciates the opportunity to see the doctor that he wants to see. And,
well, you can do that with a single payer healthcare system.
But
let's not debate an issue here. What I'm curious about, Craig, because you're the guy that makes all this happen. How, you know, what lessons can liberals learn from you guys about how to get our message out? Because you are one of the best. I mean, you really do a very good job of getting the message out, the conservative message, and a very good job of, you know, as I said, delivering guests to this show. What can we learn from you?
Well, a couple of things. First off, in headlines, mm-hmm. it's always it's never a new study by a wacko liberal group says world ending tomorrow. The headline is always world ending tomorrow. New liberal group study shows. You always lead with the punch.
Oh, I see.
You always lead with any pitch with the most gripping part of it. It's world
right.
ending tomorrow,
right.
not new study by a group right. that did X and thus and such says world
right.
ending tomorrow.
So instead of saying IPCC comes out with new studies saying that the world is ending tomorrow, it should be world ends tomorrow says IPCC.
Exactly.
Yeah. Put your
because
punch.
Especially
lead with your punch.
With your punch when people are looking at newspapers or when they're looking at press releases, and especially, as you know, a lot of my pitches are done via email because
yeah.
you're bombarded with them every day.
Yeah. My producer David is.
yeah.
God bless him.
People give it a 5-second scan. I come in the morning, I've got 100 emails. The first thing I want to do is find an excuse to delete it.
Yeah.
And the same is true for producers and hosts like yourself. The other thing, too, is always be looking at, well, what is good. What is the topic for debate here?
Yeah.
You know, what is it that people want to get into? Not just, well, what's the news? What's the implication of the news?
Right. What's the take?
What's the take on it?
What's the frame?
What is it that people are going to want to hash out?
That's one of the areas where I've watched over the years some conservative talk radio hosts do brilliantly. They get it that, you know, have a take, don't suck. You know, the old advice to talk radio hosts is true. And there are others, both on the conservative and liberal side, who haven't yet figured out that it's about, you know, having a take. It's about sharing with people not just here's the news, but here's the news and here's why you should care about it.
Right.
Here's the context of it.
And what are both sides of the issue? Because even when
why is our side better?
Well, not from the perspective of my pitch.
Right.
My pitch,
that's implicit in your pitch.
You know, you know, but again, I want to present both sides, both arguments in my pitch,
right.
so that people know what it is that they need to get on the air with us and mix it up about.
Right.
Now, one of the things that makes my job unique and particularly tough is the fact that I'm trying to get reporters to interview other reporters or
that's
talk to us
yeah.
to report.
Yeah, that's got to be a challenge. That's
yeah.
a tough one. We have to wrap it up
sure.
there, Craig. But thanks. It's an interesting conversation.
Appreciate
Craig Bannister. Yeah, the Director of Communications at CNSNews.com. Craig, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
It's 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Broadcasting live from Washington, D.C. Flag Youngblood is sitting here with me. He's the Senior Programs and Advancement Officer at the Young America's Foundation, YAF.org. I'd asked you before we went on, Flag, first of all, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Glad to have you here with us. If you guys were Young Americans for Freedom, because when I was 13, I think, I went to a YAF meeting in Lansing, Michigan. But that was long ago and far away, and you have... In fact, I wasn't your age then. I was a year older than that, obviously. But you're a young man. But Young America's Foundation has grown out of Young America's
Foundation? Well, the foundation itself was founded at Vanderbilt in the late 60s by students who were involved with YAF.
I see.
But we are completely a separate organization, and as a foundation now, focus educationally on bringing conservative messages to high school and college students throughout the nation.
And the most recent news release I have from you, or article that you wrote, is Dodging Rangel's Draft here, Charlie Rangel. Why not have a draft?
Well, our military has been best served by having a voluntary service. I mean, insofar as our nation's defenses are concerned, the most effective fighting forces have been when we have had voluntary forces.
But... You could argue that you make a better military machine, incrementally, and you know, I'll give you that. Maybe. Well, no, we could argue that. If people are doing what they want to be doing, they're going to do a better job. Sure. But we didn't fight World War II with a voluntary force.
Well, no, I mean, the number of people we needed then clearly was much larger, but you know, our military today is roughly 1% of our overall population.
And the reason why Jefferson argued so strongly in favor of universal military service or universal service of some kind, it need not all be military, and the reason why most of the industrialized countries of the world, you know, Switzerland, Germany, Sweden, I mean, most of these countries have compulsory service after high school for at least a year. You can serve in a hospital if you want, but or you can go into the military. The reason that they do is twofold. One, to create a sense of I'm in this, we're all in this together, a sense of this is my country too, this is my community too. And two, and perhaps the most important one, the one that Jefferson was most concerned about, was that if you look at the history of countries that have been overthrown from within, it's typically from a professional military.
Well, that's also typically where you don't have as strong of an executive branch either, but, you know... Today,
I mean, the argument is that, in fact, I would argue that we have a military that has been, in some ways, corrupted by the fact that it's a professional military. It has become its own institution. It's become its own advocate. And if it was filled with a lot of people who really would rather not be there, there'd be a lot more whistleblowers. We'd have, as we had during the Vietnam era, we'd have a lot more knowledge of what's going on. And frankly, I think there'd be a lot more civilian control over the military.
Well, the civilian control is there now. It's called the Commander-in-Chief. He's an elected official. When it comes to...
But he's clueless about what's going on in Rheinstein Air Force Base or whatever. I mean, you know...
Just like executives at Air America may well be clueless about what's going on the radio at a particular time. I mean, any organization...
But that's
where you
the
have
point.
Lateral...
See, I'm not sure that Air America is the best example or any radio network is the best example, but I do have listeners who are holding me accountable. I've got a whole board of them who are calling right now. We've got people who can email management. They can contact management. You go into the military, you can't do that.
Well, the military operates under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, too. It's not...
I know. It's a whole separate system. It's a whole separate legal system, and you essentially sign away about three-quarters of your rights as a U.S. citizen when you join the military, and that's why...
But in exchange, you get very clearly defined rights as well. In terms of procedures and due process, if there's
sure,
you know.
Sure. But again, if the only argument that you're making is that we should not have a military draft because if we draft people, the military will not be as effective a fighting machine.
Well, that's not the only argument. I mean,
okay.
The issue fundamentally, though, is we have a number of people out on the left who say that they support the military, but yet they do nothing on campuses to encourage people to consider military service as a noble calling. In fact, you have a number of faculty at prominent universities that actually fight against the military. And this is a situation where if military service is something that's good for the nation, which I think we can all agree upon, people should be asking others to consider serving, and instead of saying, oh, well, this really stinks, but we're going to draft you. I mean, that makes absolutely no sense. I mean,
well, I
the problem is we've got a number of people who volunteer to serve now, and really there's been an abnegation by those on the left in this country from volunteering to serve. There are very few and far
on
between.
The left.
On the left.
I mean, if you look at the number of people who have served in the military in the House of Representatives and the Senate,
and
you find
drafted,
the majority of them were Democrats, not Republicans.
And they were drafted as well.
Right. So. The Republicans figured out how to get out of the draft.
Well,
I mean, you got a bunch of chicken hawks there.
You can say what you will, but the bottom line is that if we're interested in defending the nation, we need to have the best fighting force we can. And secondly,
but that's not the main goal.
No, it is the main goal. I mean, the main goal of our national defense is to defend the nation. Our main goal is not to, you know, have a kumbaya social club.
I'm not talking about the whether or not we have a military. I'm talking about the main goal of whether you have a draft or not. The main goal of having a draft is to integrate average people into the military.
But, you know, in terms of having demographic representation now, and the small 1% that does serve, we have that. I mean, the Department of Defense's numbers play out that from all ranks and levels, we have economically, socially, racially, everybody pretty equal.
No, there's a huge group that's not represented in the military.
Well, the Ivy League isn't represented. That's certainly the case.
And people who don't want to go into the military.
Well, yes, and most of them...
people who are skeptical of the military.
Yeah, and unfortunately what they need to do is embrace the military by joining it instead of staying away from it like they do now. I don't think their attitudes are going to change by compelling them to go serve. I mean, what we should be out there doing is articulating that there's a compelling reason for people to get involved in the National
Do you really
Service.
Believe, we're talking with Flag Youngblood, he's the Senior Programs and Advancement Officer at the Young Americans Foundation, YAF.org. Do you really believe that we would still be in Iraq right now if we were operating with a draft?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, that's open for debate. You know, but the bottom line, insofar as serving the nation's interest, is the Commander-in-Chief is the one that's responsible for making those decisions. It's enumerated
no,
in the
Congress
Constitution.
Is actually.
No, Congress can declare war and can fund or defund a war.
Right.
You know, but when it talks to about giving military orders, it's the Commander-in-Chief that has ultimate responsibility for giving orders.
Okay.
And so in that regard, whatever the Commander-in-Chief says, the military does.
And the Commander-in-Chief, very intentionally, was a politician, a civilian politician.
Right, civilian
and,
control
and,
of the military.
And,
prevent,
and
military
a civilian
coup.
Politician presumably subject to public pressure.
Well, that's certainly the case, but it's ultimately the person that we elected. And
if the public pressure isn't there because people are saying, hey, you know, my kid isn't serving. I don't know anybody whose kid is serving. It's just, you know, poor folks in Appalachia who are sending their kids off. Now, we know that that's a terrible stereotype and it's not all the
well,
true.
It's completely inaccurate, actually.
Yeah, but nonetheless, I think that there's a lot of Americans who think that way, and the war doesn't touch their lives.
And it's their own fault for not getting involved. I mean... It doesn't take the hand of government for someone to become a more educated or well-balanced citizen. If anything, getting back to something John F. Kennedy said, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country.
So therefore
people
you should have a draft.
No, quite the opposite. People should be out there working to educate about the importance of doing things on a voluntary
basis.
How
can you talk about how wonderful the military
well,
is and how important the military is
now?
And
I mean,
not say everybody should be, have an opportunity
campuses.
To participate with
You have people on college campuses nationwide talking about how it's great to join the Peace Corps and they advocate for that or they advocate for socialized medicine or nationalized health care and they advocate against the military. I mean,
and you've got people on campuses advocating for the military
and
as well.
And that's my point. We need to encourage more people, particularly those in leadership positions like Charlie Rangel, to go out there and to encourage people to voluntarily consider service because it's a noble calling and it's something that's important for all of us. That's not happening, and that's the argument I'm really fundamentally making. I mean, the draft, you know, is something clearly that is not preferable given our demonstrated military history in this country.
It's
I mean, especially when there's a contentious action like Vietnam was, like Iraq is.
Yeah, and I think that Vietnam probably would have dragged on another 10 years if there hadn't been a draft.
Well, we probably would have won, too.
Okay.
In terms of, absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, we won that war militarily.
We are now winning, if you want to use that phrase, that war diplomatically and economically. We're trading,
we've recognized Vietnam, and, you know, fortunately the communist threat that has been there has died down. I mean, there was a whole geopolitical...
Threat?
Absolutely. There was a geopolitical threat posed during the Cold War, which is why we went into Vietnam in the first place. John F. Kennedy dragged us in there, and Lyndon Johnson...
Actually, it was Eisenhower. Eisenhower was the guy who put the first people on the ground
yes,
after,
his advisors,
in 1957
after
the French pulled out.
That pulled weapons and shot were put in there by Kennedy.
Yeah, well, be that
those
as it may.
Those were military advisors that Eisenhower put in. That's a wholly different matter.
Yeah, well, we were still calling them military advisors when LBJ was president.
Well, you know, semantics...
Yeah,
but
this gets back to my point that if we had some form of compulsory service, not entirely military.
I think your objective with compulsory service is because you have a political end state in mind, which is you don't like the war in Iraq, you don't like military action in general, so what's the best way to cripple military action or prevent it from being effective?
I'm not opposed to military action in general.
Fair enough.
If World War II was going on right now, I would probably volunteer.
Well,
and I'll tell you,
that's noble
if Mexico
do.
Or Canada were to invade us in order to throw George Bush out of office, I'd be out in the streets trying to repel them. even if it was to throw George Bush out of office.
Oh, understandable.
And I think that I speak for the vast majority of liberals and progressives, by the way.
Oh,
we are not the caricature that you guys try to lay out there.
Well, I'm not trying to paint a caricature. I mean, we're having an honest dialogue and discussion here, which is what needs to happen. But, you know, the best way for people, if they have particular issues with the military that they want to change, to change them is to either petition at the level of Congress or actually embrace and engage with the military by joining and work your way up through the ranks to make change happen.
And, well, I guess we're kind of talking in circles here because,
well,
you know, we're getting, because, again, my response would be, and the way you make that happen is you have everybody
involved
in the military.
Well, that's an expedient way of doing it. It's not necessarily the best for the stated purpose of the military.
You know, Jefferson wrote, "I hope we shall never see the day when our young men are willing to be shot at for a sixpence." He believed that there should not be a standing army during times of peace.
Well,
and number two, no one would argue
that we have an army now that's doing it on a mercenary basis. They're certainly not the best paid out there when it comes to, you know,
well,
the civilian world.
And tragically, the mercenary army is the second largest army in Iraq. You've got 100,000 paid contractors. You know, it's we're outsourcing, but that's a whole other thing.
Right, right.
Flag Youngblood, Senior Programs and Advancement Officer at Young Americas Foundation, YAF.org. Flag, thanks for dropping by.
Well, thanks. I appreciate the chance.
45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
6:36, 3:03, 22:70. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. The Lone Liberal, broadcasting live from the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington, D.C. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. We've covered a lot of territory today. I just to summarize my thoughts on the military, frankly, Jefferson's thoughts. He suggested that there should not be a standing army during time of peace, that we should have a navy to protect our borders, but that every person should be a member of the military, that is, of a local militia. Every male between the ages of 14 and 47 was his proposal, and should have a gun in the closet, and if the church bells ring a certain way, then everybody grabs their gun and steps out into the street, and boom, the whole country is the army. And otherwise, you have no military. And he was quite outspoken about that. In fact, that's what led to the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment, it actually was the law, and in the Constitution in Pennsylvania for a while, that there was a citizens' militia, a compulsory citizens' militia. And the Second Amendment originally started out as that, and it got whittled away to the point where it was just left with, and everybody has a gun. And they forgot about the part about everybody has to be part of the militia. So I think that there's something healthy, frankly, about it. It's about national service, not specifically military service, but the idea of national service. The year that I lived in Germany, we worked with an international relief agency, and there were a lot of young men and women who came through there, young men mostly. I believe it's just compulsory for men in Germany, who came through, who worked for a year in the program as their service, because they didn't want to go into the military, because they were pacifists or whatever. They just didn't want to be in the military. I think it's a healthy thing. Patrick in Riverside, California. Hey, Patrick, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Hey, sorry,
yeah.
Tom. Hello.
Yeah, what's up, Patrick?
Yeah, first-time caller. I'm backtracking a bit. I want to go back to the first guest you had on talking about the health care system here.
Yeah, if you say a boot, I'm guessing you're Canadian.
Hey?
Yes. It's in a boot, eh?
I live here in the States now. I've been a citizen for a number of years, but most of my family still lives in Canada. Now, this is allegorical. It's not empirical. But just wanted to give you some examples of how well the Canadian system works. My 82-year-old mother, she was 82 then, 3 years ago had a heart attack, rushed to the hospital, had good care. 6 months later, during a follow-up, her local cardiologist found out that she had swelling of her heart. 2 days later, she was rushed to one of the best cardiac centers in Canada to see a specialist. My sister was diagnosed with cancer about 2 years ago. She spent 6 weeks in a treatment facility, and this is all covered under the Canadian Universal Health Care.
Sure, you get all of this for your $40 a month.
And not only that, she was provided. She lives about 100 miles outside of Toronto, and she was provided free transportation to go back and forth to this facility. Hmm. My mother, who had the heart attack, for 2 years afterwards, she was provided with cardiotherapy free of charge. All of it covered under the Canadian healthcare plan. And this, when your guest was talking about this man, apparently, who was taking a bus across to Bangor, Maine, mm-hmm. to get an echocardiogram.
Yeah, it's the first time I've ever heard any kind of story like that, frankly.
And I'm sorry, I don't believe that story, because in any hospital or any, you know, doctor's office in Canada or the United States, if someone comes in complaining of chest pain, the first thing they do is do an echocardiogram. So either that man was outright lying or your guest was lying. I don't know.
Yeah.
And that's the same old tired canard that Republicans play all the time here in the States. Oh, we can't have a system like Canada's because, you know, we'll have waiting lines and people are going to drop dead waiting in line, waiting right. for their...
And it's nonsense. And the bottom line is we can't have a system like Canada has because, then Bill Frist's daddy wouldn't become one of the richest men in America.
Yeah, well, exactly. And the thing I find so outrageous about it is that... And so many Americans that I still talk to don't really know how the Canadian health system works, but everyone is covered. Yeah. No one ever has to worry about whether they go to an emergency room or their doctor's office, especially an emergency room.
Right. And you don't make employment decisions based on, am I going to lose my health care?
Well, exactly.
I mean, this is just
no
crazy.
One,
this is another way that the conservatives, this is another way that the corporations and the conservative choir gain control over individuals this is another way to, you know, it's another hand around the throat. Patrick, thanks for the call. Well said. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Lonnie in Kansas City, Missouri. Hey, Lonnie, what's up?
Hi, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
Good to talk to you today. I just wanted to backtrack a little bit, too. I was, when you were talking about global warming.
Yeah.
I know I learned in school that our Earth is just like a top that spins on an axis.
Right.
And what I never hear the scientists talk about are the billions of gallons of weight that we take out of the earth and what effect that has on it.
That's an interesting question. I believe that a lot of drilling, they inject water in to replace the oil. But there's probably also a lot of drilling where they just pull the oil out. I remember somebody speculating about that some years ago. And to the best of my knowledge, there's no science on it. I just don't know. But
the same amount of water is on the earth that was here when it was created or evolved or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
The water just goes around. I watched a special on the Science Channel a few months ago about it. About how water starts out in one side.
No,
of the
but
earth.
my point is, if you inject water into an oil well, then you haven't so much redistributed weight. But yeah, it's an interesting question, Lonnie. I appreciate the call. We've got to wrap up the show though, because I think I'm hearing the music in the background. Yep, I guess I am. And so we'll be back tomorrow, our final day. I promise you, at the Conservative Political Action Conference. CPAC.org, if the website, if you want to check it out. Tomorrow, Dick Cheney, I doubt he's going to come on the program. I really do. But he's going to be here and a whole bunch of interesting folks, shall we say. We'll get the whole skinny on it. So, see you tomorrow. And remember, democracy begins with you, my friends. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.